It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our state capitol reporter brings us up to date on a flurry of activity as the state Senate ended its session, including action on insurance coverage of oral chemotherapy medications.
First, we're talking about a new report that ranks Wisconsin 46th in Wisconsin's economic growth and clout. The report looked at how many women-owned businesses there are, how much money those businesses make, and how many people they employ. Even though things have been improving for female entrepreneurs in the Badger State, we're still lagging behind nationally.
We have two guests with us to talk about this news. Deborah Ellis Brock is the South Central Regional Project Director for Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corporation. Excuse me. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And also with us, Christine Lidbury. She's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Women's Council. Christine, hi.
Hi, thank you.
Well, let's start with your reaction to this news, this ranking, Deborah. Were you surprised to learn that Wisconsin is near the bottom of national rankings when it comes to the economic clout of women?
Well, you know, the 46th ranking nationally is really for the rate of change over the period of 1997 to 2014, not for how Wisconsin necessarily compares to other states for the current share of businesses in the state that are women-owned. However, you know, I do think that we still have a long way to go in support of women's business and increasing women's economic empowerment. So, you know, surprised but not so surprised, because we still do have some work to do in those areas.
Christine, as Deborah mentioned, this is a rate of change thing. What is our baseline? How are we in Wisconsin doing when it comes to women in business?
So we have about 26% of businesses in Wisconsin are women-owned, slightly behind the national average, but not really that much. You know, the interesting thing from my perspective on that is that, you know, we ranked, I'm trying to look at the numbers here. We ranked, you know, about 20 or 29th in the nation for women-owned businesses, you know, back in 2007, and we flipped a little bit before that from 2002, and now I think we're flipping a little bit as we look at the projections for 2014. So that trend is a little worrying. But in general, you see really a really robust, you know, women's business climate and women's businesses in Wisconsin.
Yeah, because we're slipping in rankings, it doesn't mean the number of women-owned businesses are going down. It might mean we're just not increasing as quickly as everybody else.
Right. And, you know, one of my concerns is that if you take a state that might have had low business ownership and they're kind of playing catch up, they're going to show a really high rate of change, right, if they're sort of catching up and doing a good job of getting their women-owned businesses on track. And so that may not reflect all that well for us. Wisconsin also did have a loss in the share of women-owned businesses in the state between about 2002 and 2007. So we are catching up a little bit from that as well. And the hope is that we are back on the upswing.
Before we dig deeper into the challenges, the obstacles facing women in business nationally and here in Wisconsin, Deborah, why is it important for women to play a big role in Wisconsin's economy?
Well, you know, women tend to, you know, really put their income back into their community. They really drive literacy. You know, they really drive education. And I think that, you know, as more women are empowered economically, you know, you're really creating stronger communities, stronger individuals, and stronger diversity in communities. You know, we've certainly seen, you know, in, you know, organizations like the Wisconsin Women's Business Center, you know, we served over 3,000 clients last year, and that number's growing. So there's a demand for women in business, and, you know, we're really seeing that that impacts communities.
Christine, what are some of the unique challenges that might keep women out of, say, opening a business, getting into entrepreneurship?
Well, you know, I think money is, and we've been talking about this for years, access to capital is a huge issue for women. I think, you know, it's hard to get banks to lend to startups to begin with. And so women tend to rely on family and friends and their own savings for starting and growing their businesses. And also, I think more and more you're seeing women who have other role models in the community. But I think until fairly recently, that was a challenge of just seeing other women who had run the kinds of businesses they run, have the kind of leadership that they would like to have.
And Deborah, apart from startups and entrepreneurship, how about some of Wisconsin's bigger businesses? Are we seeing women as a growing presence on things like boards of directors or in CEO or other high up offices?
You know, in 2013, the percentage of board seats held by women in Fortune 500 companies nationwide did jump to 18% in 2013 from 17.1% in 2012 and about 16.4% in 2011. That's according to, you know, the 2020 report on women on boards. However, that is still such a small percentage, so there is still room for growth there. And, you know, moving forward, continued dialogue, visibility, and mentorship is needed to really allow, you know, women to really come to those boardrooms and to the table and really speak on those issues. And, you know, they find that when you do add women to boards, you're really seeing more diverse and successful companies.
And I think Deborah's raising a good point. You know, those numbers, those national numbers, are actually well above the Wisconsin numbers, which are closer to 14%, and have really been stagnant for quite a while. They move at a really incremental, glacial kind of pace.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing women and moving women into those leadership posts. And I think sometimes people even talk about, you know, the opportunities for women who are executives to have those purchase options for small and medium-sized businesses, but they have to be at a certain level to even think about that sort of thing.
So we've heard for years about the glass ceiling. What is it that accounts for that fairly slow growth nationwide and what you call the stagnant situation in Wisconsin? Deborah, let's start with you.
Sure. You know, while those barriers are really deep-seated and multidimensional, one of the firmest barriers has been the nature of how boards of directors recruit new members. You know, I think when it comes to women in business, I think it really comes down to social capital, really increasing those networks. You know, there's some great organization, you know, women's business organizations out there that are really working to improve that, you know, such as the Doyen Group in Madison. You know, there is Tempo Women's Group, there is Professional Dimensions. You know, organizations like that are really working on that key element of connectivity and social capital. And I think also, you know, some of those other barriers, you know, as Christine mentioned earlier, is that access to funding, that access to quality business education, and beyond that, for sustainability and growth for women's business, is really that ongoing, you know, technical assistance, one-on-one counseling and support networks that are needed.
Christine, are we seeing efforts targeting women-owned businesses, women entrepreneurs to get that funding that you two have been talking about?
Well, and I might even defer to Deborah on that. I mean, I think WIBIC does an amazing job of looking at microlending, you know, being able to lend in smaller amounts of money than you might see in some large banks.
Mm-hmm.
And she can probably talk about some of the programs and resources that are available in Wisconsin. And I think Wisconsin really is in good shape with organizations like WIBIC. And I know the Small Business Administration has been urging small businesses and women to really look at community banks and credit unions that might be more interested in investing in the community and more open to looking at someone's business plan and experience for capital funding.
And Deborah, microloans, I've heard of that in the context of, you know, first world to third world kind of loans. That's happening here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. There is such a strong need for that initial startup funding. You know, especially, you know, when we're looking at women's business centers that are focused on, you know, giving women even more equity and starting, you know, solid business and growth businesses in the community. You know, microloans specifically target and reach out to women and family-owned businesses. With those smaller loans, you know, typically, you know, an organization like WIBIC, you know, we do our lending anywhere from $1,000 up to $100,000. So really that startup seed funding that is so important to get businesses off the ground. And a lot of women, when they, you know, not to, you know, just blanket across the board, but especially with small startups, a lot of women are coming from economically challenged backgrounds. And so those microloan programs are really designed for individuals who may not necessarily be bankable by commercial banking standards, but really give them that opportunity to access the funding they need to, you know, start that business and continue to grow that business.
Christine, from the perspective of women in the business world, are there things that they can do to be better advocates for themselves?
Well, I think, you know, searching out some of these opportunities like the WIBICs of the world, some of the organizations like Tempo that are really working and Milwaukee Women Inc. that are really working to put women in leadership roles, getting a mentor. You know, I know that there's a woman I know here in Madison who runs a biotech company, and she's talked very much about how it's difficult for women to break into some of these really hot, high demand science and technology fields because they're really strongly male dominated. And she probably wouldn't call it sexism, but she would say it's definitely in the numbers, you know. So finding other women who work in those fields that you would like to go into to get some mentoring, to get some advice, to break into those networks and grow your companies.
That's Christine Lidbury with the Wisconsin Women's Council. Also with us, Deborah Ellis Brock with WIBIC. That's the Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corporation, talking about the economic state of women in Wisconsin. Mixed numbers, depending how you look at them. Some numbers showing the state is near the bottom when it comes to the economic clout of women-owned businesses and the rate of growth of those businesses. We want to hear from you. What do you think about this? Are you surprised to hear Wisconsin, by some measures, is lagging nationally? Or does this line up with what you've seen, what you've experienced? Are you a woman who owns a business or on the board of a corporation or trying to make your way in the business world? Do you find it difficult? Are there unique challenges to you because you're a woman? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk at WPR.org. We pick up our discussion now on the economic clout of women and women-owned businesses in Wisconsin. We've got Deborah Ellis Brock of the Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corporation and Christine Lidbury of the Wisconsin Women's Council. And how about you? What do you think are some of the challenges facing women in the world of business, whether a big business or startups, a small business, a local business? Are you a business owner? Have you tried opening a business? What's it been like? What are some of the unique challenges as a woman in the business world? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you wish somebody had told you when you got into the business world, when you opened up your own entrepreneurial endeavor? 800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk at WPR.org. Deborah, are there things in Wisconsin that make us unique in terms of challenges for women or opportunities for women?
You know, I do think that we have a lot of great opportunity, and really looking forward, I think we really need to be solutions oriented when we look at these numbers. You know, I think we have a great opportunity in Wisconsin to really grow and expand, you know, organizations and dedicate funding to programs that really help promote women, you know, such as women's business centers like WIBIC, you know, across the country, you know, 137,000 business owners and potential entrepreneurs were helped by women's business centers. You know, I think continuing to increase outreach to women and grow the program, expand those microloan programs we discussed earlier in the program, and also community development financial institutions or CDFIs, you know, they're advancing responsible capital and many focus on working families and women. And, you know, there's over 871 CDFIs across our nation. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, they're doing great work to really help reinvest in women. So I really think it's a matter of, you know, focused reinvestment. And, you know, we as a society really need to increase programs providing support to women-owned business ventures. And women in turn need to lend a hand to other women and men and bring them along the journey for the good, you know, and for all in our community.
And Christine, those things Deborah was just talking about, do you see them growing, expanding in Wisconsin and into more parts of the state?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, especially when you look at northwestern Wisconsin, northeastern Wisconsin, you really do see those things through the business development centers and the community development programs coming up. I guess what I would say, too, is that so many economic development programs don't specifically target women-owned businesses, not that they're not eligible for them. And I think, you know, the idea is that, well, they're open to everybody. But I think women, you know, need to be mentored along or invited along to participate. Women don't tend to want to capitalize their their companies once they're up and running. So, you know, keeping them growing is a challenge and helping them to really figure out how those organizations can benefit them and how they specifically speak to these women-owned businesses is really important.
Deborah, are there sectors in the Wisconsin economy that women are doing particularly well in?
You know, here I know from, you know, WIBIC's numbers, you know, we do assist, you know, a lot of small business owners. You know, we find a wide array of businesses, anywhere from food-related services. You know, we've really started a food business planning class to focus on those women entrepreneurs in retail and wholesale trade. We've found those increasing. You know, but women, you know, are going into a wide array of sectors, technology sectors. It's not really limited so much. You know, but we do find that, you know, at the top of what we're finding at WBIC, you know, it's a lot of wholesale, you know, and manufacturing, food-related services. But then you have groups like Doyen, which are million and multi-million dollar businesses owned by women that are, you know, really at the forefront of mentoring and bringing up other women in the community.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Krista with us from McHenry, Illinois. Krista, hi.
Hi.
What's your experience?
I am 25 years old. I just graduated with an MBA, and so I've just entered my career and my working. I work in a manufacturing company that's rather large. I just relocated to Illinois for this company, and I've definitely felt the struggles. I've been in this job since August, and I've already felt the struggle being a woman in a male-dominated work environment.
What is it? What's different for you than from your male colleagues?
I don't know if it's necessarily. I feel like being a woman in this industry, I currently work in HR, and I feel like that was my way in the door as a woman. Is women work in HR? So, aspiring to be an executive someday and aspiring to run the business, I have to really grow my network within this community. And I wish there would have been more emphasis on that in school. I'm learning now that it's important to grow this network, and I feel behind because I didn't grow it when I was in college because I didn't realize the importance of it. And finding a mentor, someone was speaking about that, the importance of that, and now I'm working on that, finding that mentor within this industry and within this company and trying to grow my professional career that way.
Krista, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Christine, do you think that's a common story, maybe women coming into the work world, they didn't have the network that some of their colleagues might?
I do, and I think that Krista's raised a couple of really good points. One is that women often end up in places like accounting and HR, which are wonderful fields, but if you want to move up into business ownership or high-level executive positions, being in marketing and product development and sales and, you know, getting out with the customers is really important, and somewhere along the line, someone needs to help you onto that path. We see that with women, even, you know, when we talk about women on boards, the kinds of experience they have and that they look for on boards of directors. And so I think Krista's done a good job, actually, of figuring that out really early in her career, that building those networks. And, you know, a lot of companies, some of the really big manufacturing companies, have women's affinity networks in their companies to really help women navigate those career paths.
Deborah, why do you think that is, that women end up in HR and accounting and not maybe the higher profile marketing, product development things? Do companies want, like, move women there, or do women come in thinking that's where they can get in? Where's that coming from?
You know, I think it's a matter of access and opportunity. You know, I think that we really need to reevaluate giving, you know, women more opportunity in those areas. And I think it's just historically, I don't see that those positions have been open to women. But see, this is where, you know, I think Kristen, the caller, brought in a good point, is that joining the networks is important, but women also need to be advocates for themselves as well. I think self-advocacy is such an important role, you know, to stand up and raise awareness about those things, really, you know, talk to management, upper management, you know, let them know that you're interested in climbing up the ladder, you know, make that intent known. And I think self-advocacy plays a huge role in that. But also to couple that, mentorship is important and sponsorship is a powerful agent of change, which is a little bit different. It's more than just a coach. You know, a sponsor is someone who will help you move into a role by sometimes standing up for you or offering your name or making sure you can get on the right track. You know, and I think that strong leaders are already doing those kinds of things. And I think that as more companies look at the value of women in leadership roles and bringing more women into, you know, the broader spectrum of roles, they find that companies are more successful overall with that.
We'll leave it there. Deborah, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us. It was a pleasure.
Christine, thanks to you as well.
Oh, thank you so much for raising this topic.
We've been talking to Deborah Ellis Brock. She's South Central Regional Project Director for Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corporation. And Christine Lidbury, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Women's Council. They were with us to talk about a new report, at least one way of looking at things. Wisconsin is near the bottom nationally when it comes to the growth of women-owned businesses. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday for a look at what's going on in Congress.
First, the state Senate wrapped up their legislative session yesterday.
A lot of bills on the table dealing with everything from oral chemotherapy to DNA collection. So what passed the Senate and what missed the cut?
Here to give us a roundup of a smorgasbord of activity at the state capitol is Sean Johnson. He's WPR's state capitol reporter. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, the big drama in the last few weeks of the session was this oral chemotherapy bill. A lot of question as to whether it would pass. What ended up coming down in the Senate after a bumpy road?
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, it did pass, though it's not the clean version of the bill. It was bottled up in committee a few weeks ago and that already passed the Senate on a 30-2 vote. You know, essentially what happened with this bill, if you want to go through all the procedural gymnastics, you know, this is something that Republican leaderships used a very unusual tactic to keep it from getting a vote in the Senate. There was kind of a public backlash. A lot of legislators came out and said, we got to act on this. The Senate voted on it and it passed 30-2. That bill would have required insurance companies to charge the same for coverage of chemotherapy, whether it's delivered at home with a pill or at a clinic through an IV. Got bumped over to the Assembly. The Assembly didn't like that. They added an amendment that would have allowed for a $100 monthly copay for chemotherapy drugs. Then the Senate yesterday kind of reluctantly accepted that amendment. And on a vote of 26-7, they sent it to the governor's desk, and he's going to sign it.
Since it was coming down to the wire, there was concern that any amendment in the Assembly might just postpone the bill to the next session, right?
Yeah, and if you listen to people's comments on the floor, even Republican author Alberta Darling, a state senator from River Hills, they didn't like that amendment. You know, there were some Democrats arguing that this was creating just a big loophole for insurance companies that, you know, in fact, it wouldn't be $100 a month that insurance companies would be able to charge that copay for every drug in a chemo cocktail for some patients. And then that the amendment was kind of silent on whether insurance companies could increase deductibles or coinsurance to make up the difference. You know, those concerns aside, this is the end of session, and the Assembly already said it was going home, and this was the deal that was on the table. And so, you know, you had a few more no votes yesterday, but ultimately a pretty strong vote sending it to the governor's desk.
So it was take it or leave it for supporters of that bill. Well, another bill that passed the Senate had to do with medical application of cannabis oil. What would that do?
Yeah, and to be clear, this is not medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an issue that Republican majority here has shown no interest in supporting. And really, you know, it's been a few years now, but when Democrats ran things, they didn't want to pass that bill either. This is a different issue, and it would legalize the use of a marijuana byproduct. I have trouble pronouncing this, cannabidiol. Essentially, it's got a very low levels of the drug THC, which is the substance in marijuana that gives users a high. And this bill would lift which essentially a blanket prohibition on this substance right now, and would let doctors prescribe it for seizure disorders. And this is something that was pushed very hard by parents of kids with seizure disorders who said that they've tried everything else, tried, you know, more than a dozen medications in some of these cases. It's given their kids stomach disorders, liver disorders. They want to try something new. They've heard that this doesn't have those kinds of side effects. And you actually had a number of parents in the gallery yesterday when this passed. They were in tears as the Senate was taking this up, and they all cheered when it passed 32-0.
And has this already passed the Assembly?
It has, and it had a similar, they had a unanimous voice vote over there. So, you know, even though this is a byproduct of marijuana, you didn't see, you know, any of those arguments come out. I mean, you didn't see any opponents come out and say this is a slippery slope. This had, you know, nearly every legislator on board. And it sounds like the governor is going to sign it as well.
And assuming he does, do we know when this would be available to those parents or their kids?
You know, that I don't know. I don't I'm not sure when it takes effect.
A lot of medical news from the Senate yesterday. Also a bill on doctors' apologies and how it affects lawsuits. Tell us about that one.
This is a bill that has been around in one form or another since 2005, and it's always, you know, been defeated in one way or another. Back in 2005, it was then Governor Jim Doyle who ultimately vetoed that bill. But in other sessions, it just hasn't gone anywhere. It would, you know, the basic premise of the bill is the same now as it was then. It would say that, you know, a doctor would be able to say, I'm sorry, or express some kind of compassion to a family of, you know, a patient who died, without worrying that those words alone were going to put have the doctor get sued. So, you know, the concept there is something that I think a lot of people support. I think what gets tricky with this bill is that it's not just about doctors saying, I'm sorry. You know, it does go beyond that. As critics pointed out, it talks about any statement, gesture, or conduct that expresses an apology, remorse, or even fault, that would be inadmissible as evidence in court. So it's one of those bills that's short and sounds simple, but as you read it, you could imagine different scenarios where this could be used to prevent a lawsuit.
So this could cover everything from a neutral statement like, I'm sorry, we did everything we could, to I'm sorry, we made a mistake. But even that saying we made a mistake in the context of an apology, it sounds like then couldn't be used in the course of a lawsuit.
Yeah, that was one of the examples. I mean, the examples like those were thrown out by opponents during debate. And so, you know, I guess we won't know until it gets tested. The bill would not prevent those types of statements from coming out in discovery, before a case goes forward, but you couldn't present it to a jury once the case has gone to court.
And that one, again, expected to be signed by the governor?
His office only said that he would review it. I would imagine, though, on bills like this, he's generally going to side, I think it's probably likely he's going to sign this. He's only vetoed one bill outright since he's been governor. That happened about a week ago. But, you know, most of the time he's on the same page as the legislature.
And four state senators on their way out gave their farewell remarks yesterday. Three Democrats, I think one Republican. Similar message. They want more compromise in the state legislature. Can you give us a little taste of what they had to say?
Yeah, State Senator John Lehman, a Democrat from Racine. State Senator Tim Cullen, Democrat from Janesville. State Senator Bob Jauch, Democrat from Poplar. And State Senator Dale Schultz, a Republican from Richland Center, all gave their farewell speeches in the Senate. Schultz, Cullen, and Jauch have really, at this point in their careers, kind of become kindred spirits. You know, they've all been around for a while. They've seen a lot, and they seem to have hit this point where they all, agree with each other on many of the issues of the day. And they really did hit that common theme of it's not like it used to be. We used to work together a lot more, and we don't anymore. That partisanship has taken over the place, and there's just no politics for the common good in the state Senate anymore. So they sort of ended on a positive note and urged people to get back to that. But at the same time, it's that atmosphere that's part of the reason that they said they're leaving.
Any sense that their colleagues listened? Do you think we might see more of that kind of compromise in the next session?
They listened yesterday in the sense that both the leaders decided that the more partisan speeches they were about to give to cap off the session, they just save those for later and give them to the press on their own. So for one evening, that bipartisan tone won the day. But no, I mean, I don't think that next session is going to be any different than this one.
All right, Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson. He's WPR's state capitol reporter, catching us up on yesterday's smorgasbord of activity in the state Senate.
Coming up in just a moment, it's time for a weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
It's time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Yesterday, Wisconsin's Paul Ryan released his proposal aimed at balancing the federal budget. Is it a political statement or a document with a chance of passing?
Also yesterday, General Motors' Mary Barra was on the hot seat in front of Congress over GM's faulty ignition switches. We're used to seeing executives kind of shamed in front of Congress, but what do these kinds of testimonies accomplish?
And the conflict between the Senate and the CIA continues with the impending release of the Senate's report on CIA interrogation practices.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, it's great to have you with us.
Hey, how you doing, Veronica?
Doing okay. Thanks for joining us. I know you're on vacation now, so appreciate your time.
No trouble.
Yeah, we heard yesterday from Maya McGinnis on the show talking about Paul Ryan's 2015 budget proposal. And our guest, Maya McGinnis, said it was presented mostly as a political document, an agenda setter. But how is it going over in Washington?
As a political document and an agenda setter. I mean, the House of Representatives begins voting on this thing today and the next few days in committee, and then probably next week as well on the House floor they'll be debating it. But there's no way for it to pass. I mean, for starters, the budget assumes the repeal of Obamacare. The President of the United States is not going to sign that, and the Senate is not going to pass it.
Well, it assumes it, but it's also the whole budget seems to be predicated on that. What kind of message does that send?
Well, that's what I mean. Is that they don't think that? I mean, I think it is clear at this point that they're not going to be able to pass that through this Congress. So if they're putting it in a budget document, then the assumption is they're putting the document in order to make a political statement, which is, this is what we would do in a Republican Congress if we had control. This is what we would do if we had a Republican White House. It is really just an opportunity to spend 2 weeks talking about the Republican agenda, which focuses heavily on stuff like flattening the tax rates, cutting some of the discretionary spending, and again, eliminating the Affordable Care Act. But those things are issues that the Republicans want to continue talking about it. The Democrats, frankly, in the Senate probably aren't even going to offer a budget at all because they don't need to. They already had a deal in the House and the Senate. They passed in January for a 2-year budget. So this bill doesn't really have a purpose.
Right. So as you say, the Senate has no intentions really or any need to take this up, but will portions of it come back down the road?
Oh, sure. I mean, if you look at the document closely, you'll see most of it is stuff that Republicans have been pushing for anyway. Again, the repeals of Obamacare, some of the changes in the tax rates, some of the reductions in discretionary spending, cuts in food stamps and Medicare and Medicaid. There's actually some interesting proposals in here that I suspect you would see if there's a Republican Senate after the elections. I suspect that these would be very high on the list of things they might try to achieve.
One of the other things... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, until the elections change the state of play, none of this could become law.
Now, one of the other things besides the repeal of Obamacare that catches your attention in this budget is the privatization option for Medicare. Is that something that caught your eye, too, as something which could have some political weight down the road?
Well, sure, down the road. I mean, this is one of those things that the Democrats will latch on to argue during the 2014 election cycle and beyond for older people. You don't want to vote for the Republicans because they want to privatize Medicare. And this is this battle that has run on for years, and I suspect will continue to run on for years. The fact of the matter is, everybody agreed our entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, are running at a rate that will bankrupt them sooner or later, and they have to figure out a way to fix them. Nobody's come up with a way yet, and nobody's come up with a way we can pass and agree to pass. This is a Republican approach that is not brand new, and I suspect will be highlighted by both parties come November.
And it would, supposedly, if it were implemented, balance the budget in 10 years. What about that? Is that something that's a priority for Republicans and maybe Democrats? Should it be?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't put too much weight on any of that. Any 10-year estimate of any budget is absurd at this point because they keep changing spending habits every year anyway. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in this particular budget, they achieve balance in part because they argue that large macroeconomic changes caused by the change in tax policy will create more revenue, which is really theoretical. So there's no real math here. This is budget math. We're not balancing the budget in 10 years off of any of these bills at this point.
How would it look as a document intended to launch Paul Ryan to a presidential bid?
Well, honestly, at the moment, I think what Paul Ryan is really angling for is the chairmanship of the House Ways and Means Committee, where he would be able to actually start writing some of the tax law changes he wants. That's sort of where I anticipate seeing him in 2 years. It's conceivable still he would run for president, I guess. But he's the kind of wonky guy who might really appreciate and be good at chairing the Ways and Means Committee. And that certainly seems where he's angling for now.
Moving on to a different perspective of Congress, Mary Barra, CEO General Motors, sat before Congress yesterday to answer questions about her company's faulty ignition switches. Now, should we expect to see anything concrete come from that bit of testimony and maybe a bit of public shaming combined?
I think to see a bunch of things. I'm not sure how could they connect to the testimony. I mean, for instance, I would not be surprised to see GM try to create some kind of a trust fund to pay claims to victims of these fatal accidents. You would be, well, at the moment I know that the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration is investigating its own actions regarding GM. I know that GM is investigating its own actions. I mean, there's a whole series of things that are going to come out of this, and Congress is going to drive some portion of it, because they are going to start looking very closely at, for instance, the bankruptcy documents that General Motors filed in which they voided their liability for any past actions. Congress is going to take a look at that and say, well, did they know at the time that this was something that was on the table? And if so, should we void their immunity? A bunch of stuff Congress could look at here that could get, I suspect, is going to drag on for quite a while.
Wait, so theoretically their immunity could be taken away?
Well, theoretically. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that Congress likes to do, and obviously it would be extraordinarily punitive to a bunch of shareholders. But, yeah, in theory, if they were to say that the company lied or knew it was not telling the truth or was hiding something at the time, you could make a case for removing their immunity.
Well, switching to infighting among Washington insiders, the CIA and the Senate are currently on bad terms, and the source of the tension, a still-secret Senate report, which allegedly shows that there was no link between harsh interrogation and finding Osama bin Laden. What are relations like between the CIA and Congress right now?
Terrible. Bleak House kind of terrible. I mean, at the debate over this report has become a dispute that the CIA accused the Senate of improperly accessing materials off the CIA computer. The Senate accused the CIA of spying on the Senate to find out what materials had been downloaded. They are forwarding the matter to the Justice Department for possible criminal prosecution. I mean, it's just this. Huh. It's become a mess. And the heart of this is the interrogations, the sort of harsh interrogations and the waterboarding that took place before the Obama administration took over and basically put the kibosh on it. And it's not only the interrogations that's the problem. The problem is Congress believes the CIA lied to Congress about what intelligence they were gathering from those harsh interrogations. What Congress believes is that the waterboarding and the harsh interrogations produced nothing of value, but the CIA told them it did in order to defend the program.
Well, the congressional panel is going to be voting on whether to declassify a summary of the report tomorrow. If that happens, what's at stake?
you know, what is at stake is a reopening of one of the most painful chapters in American history. What is at stake is a public conversation again about, did the United States knowingly torture prisoners in order to try and shake loose information about terrorist attacks? And, comma, did the CIA lie about what they were doing? Did they lie about what information they were getting? Were they getting any useful information? No matter what happens here, and when this report becomes public, I suspect pieces of it are becoming public now, even though they haven't released it. It is going to reopen a window on a detail of a very ugly period of American history, and an argument can be made whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, but it was an ugly thing one way or the other, and it's going to be an unpleasant conversation.
All right. We may be talking about it next week, too. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and have a great day.
You too. We're talking to Paul Singer, USA Today politics and Congress editor. He joins us every week at this time to give us the lowdown on Washington.